Rewind. Now we wait it. Radio Rewind. Now we wait it. Radio Rewind. Radio Rewind. The following content has previously aired on CJSF. But don't worry, we'll be back next week with fresh content. CJSF 90.1 FM. Diverse. Independent. Yours.
This is a space for showcasing conversations about all the interesting and important things the faculty and students are doing at FCAT.
What we hope is to have engaged and informed conversations focused on current issues of the day. Thank you for listening.
In this installment of Speakable, we begin to ask an impossibly broad question. What about AI? How does AI feature into research, teaching, and the activism that is going on in FCAT? This is an issue that in one way or another touches all our work, but for this week, I was able to speak with Laura Marks in the School of Contemporary Arts and Michael Filmowicz at SEAT.
Yeah, I'm Laura Marks. I teach in the School for the Contemporary Arts here at SFU. I've got the Small File Media Festival. I have the Substantial Motion Research Network, which is artists and scholars interested in non-Western approaches to media technologies. I'm now in a research group on the environmental impact of machine learning and a couple of other things.
I'm Michael Filimovich, and I teach in the School of Interactive Arts and Technology at Simon Fraser University, Surrey campus. Yeah, right now, I guess I would say it's a new phase of my life in the sense I'm just focusing creatively on mainly one thing these days, which is electronic music and AI video, where the visuals are made by AI.
One of the first questions I asked is how they each came to AI in their research and their teaching.
Really from cinema studies and working on experimental media. I think from the earliest days, I've always been interested in the materiality of the media, you know, whether it's like celluloid film or analog video. And then especially with the rise of digital media, which people were seeing as immaterial, and especially when streaming comes along and suddenly you only have the playback medium on site, right? Because the storage medium is a data center, and that's far away, maybe even another country, and the delivery medium is a network, is, you know, probably underground somewhere. So, you know, I've just always been thinking about what is the materiality of our media, and, you know, suspicious when you know, somebody from industry says, "Oh, it's so light, it's really immaterial, it's virtual."
Oh my God, that's amazing. I want to know now about the environmental impact on machine learning.
Yeah, so now, thanks to my colleague Arne Eigenfeld, we're now starting a project to calculate the environmental impact of AI. Because Arne was inspired by my Small File Media Festival, and he is a composer who uses not generative AI, but machine learning. And he wanted to devise small file generative music. So for part of this grant, again, I'm putting together a team with two media scholars and two computer scientists.
Wow, that's amazing, Laura. I have to ask again my very first question, which is how in your trajectory of work, how did you come to this interest in environmentalism and media and from art, right?
I'll be delighted to tell you. It's a new project. The research is quite new, but it comes out of a project I did in 2020 and 2021 on calculating the carbon footprint of streaming video. And that was with a research group of two media scholars like me and two computer engineers here at SFU. And we reviewed all the literature, mostly in computer engineering and related fields, on the energy consumption of the internet and of streaming video in particular, and found out that the impact of streaming video is really, really high and so little known. The internet as a whole contributes about 4% of global greenhouse gas emissions, and that's rising at about 5% per year, and that's double the aviation industry. So people are always shocked when they hear that, because people think of the internet, or think of streaming as being immaterial, as files being stored on a cloud.
I haven't heard anything on e-waste lately, but I'm sure it'll come.
One of the cool things I learned about in this survey of computer engineering is life cycle analysis. And this is, a life cycle environmental footprint analysis. So this is looking at the whole footprint of digital devices, from the initial mining to manufacturing, to use, to disposal. And in fact, for devices, for phones in particular, the great majority of their electricity use happens in the factory, based on the idea that people are supposed to throw away their phones after 2 years. And that's also a large amount of their carbon footprint, because most of the factories where phones and other devices are made are in China, Korea, Taiwan, India, and they draw mostly on fossil fuels. So, when you look at the whole life cycle, there's a very, very heavy waste and pollution and debt to the earth.
Yeah, I was curious about whether AI or some form of automation, algorithmic automation, is becoming to feature into these pipelines, into these platforms, into these infrastructures, and is that part of your work?
So to your question now about the environmental impact of AI, it's driving, that 4% and growing that I mentioned, is growing really, really fast now. And you've probably read about or heard about the enormous expansion of data centers specifically to serve AI. And it is nuts. In the States, Microsoft and Alphabet are buying or renovating nuclear power plants. In other places, it's a lot to get into, but basically there's an enormous expansion of data centers, and where they're going to get their electricity is a very contentious question. I really think that the expansion of data centers and of information communication technologies as a whole is just one of the best examples of rampant capitalist growth that's not sufficiently government regulated, and it's really setting our planet on fire.
Given the
underlying thread of creativity, my interest with both speakers was how they understand the interplay between art and AI.
How have your interests evolved then, and how have you arrived at sort of AI?
Okay, well, so yeah, right now I guess I would say it's a new phase of my life in the sense I'm just focusing creatively on mainly one thing these days, which is electronic music and AI video, where the visuals are made by AI. In the past, I have, you know, if you look over my CV or whatever, I've worked in a lot of different media, you know, public art, interactive installations, internet art, experimental music, whatever, soundtrack, sound design. I guess as one gets older, maybe one just decides to sort of take everything you've done in the past and just like make a triangle out of it, like bring it all to one point, like just take all that past stuff you've done and just like bring everything to like one thing. That's how I would sort of I'm thinking of where I'm at right now creatively is like, because with music, I mean, I've always loved music videos, and when I've taught video, I've always used music videos. I've assigned people to make students make music videos. It's just something that's always can be culturally relevant. It's a way to bring in lots of creativity into a course. Practically, like in an intro video course, you can just focus on the visuals, not worry about the sounds. The sound is the music. So I've always used music videos in all kinds of ways in my courses. So yeah, I've been making music videos for a few years, and then I just jumped on the AI stuff right away. And so I started making my music videos as where the AI is doing the visuals. So I make the music the usual DAW, like digital audio workstation way, or with modular synthesis or algorithmic composition, and then the visuals are done with AI. So that's when I started getting into working with AI as an artist. Yeah.
So I'm curious. In your work, what do you think about the difference between before you started using AI and after you started using AI in terms of creativity, type of creativity, how you're becoming creative, authorship for yourself, and also how do you transfer that into the classroom? Like, what do you talk to your students about?
Okay, so I sometimes describe it as AI is the rebirth of the death of the author. that's how I kind of think of it. It's because it's all those like death of the author themes where it's not original to you. You're you know, manipulating a semiotic field that's actually manipulating you instead. There's no originality and there's no author, and it's a collective field of meaning and so on. And I'm okay with that. To me, it's like, oh yeah, this is like the 90s. this is like all that post-structuralist theory I was doing. It's like, that's what AI is. It's because I used this term that I came across in the 90s of being like a hermeneut, right? Not the opposite of hermeneutics, but sort of exploring meaning space. And AI is just a way of exploring meaning space and it's kind of like really like, you know, like one of the, like I sometimes describe semiotics as like the first systems theory. Before Bertalanffy did, you know, general systems theory, there was semiotics, which is the systems theory of language. And to me, it just feels like, It almost feels like this is what I was educated for as an undergrad and as a grad student. It's like, oh, finally it showed up as a medium you can play with. So these are some of the ways I think about it. You know, I sometimes touch on more practical things like copyright, because there's a lot of, you know, ideas about theft and stealing and copyright. And so I bring a bit of copyright law into the class. I say, you know, I know some of you think that it's just stealing from artists and so on. But the way copyright law works is the general idea of something does not belong to anybody. It's the particular concrete expression in the medium that is subject to copyright law. The general idea of something is not copyrightable. So as long as you use, unless you tell AI to give me Darth Vader, which is a copyrighted thing, for the most part, it's going to, because depending how you do prompt writing, it's not going to give you a direct, you know, copy of something. It's going to give you the general, it's going to give you an algorithmically produced output that, I think in terms of copyright law, it's the general idea of something.
much more than creativity. There are ethics, politics, authenticity, copyright. What does it mean to add AI and STIR to this already complex expression of human activity?
So something interesting then on authorship. I mean, if we keep circling through different variations of death of the author, if authorship is, and perhaps authenticity is not that important with anything that is generative, with ChatGPT, you know, in terms of writing. So if those aren't the criteria that we're going to be looking at now, because it's just not practical, as you said, what should be the criteria?
Well, there's still taste. Like the old Kantian notion, you'll go back to Kant here and aesthetic judgment, yeah. Right? Like there's still the idea of not turning out tacky crap, right? And there's still the idea of that saying that, hey, my AI art represents my education in culture and art and what I think is a valid aesthetic statement. And there's still the experience, the aesthetic experience. It could be all the classic, the sublime or whatever. There's still the holistic experience. And that is, I think, you know, that is something that you can, and that's where I think I go. And because when I'm making the AI, using AI to make art, I'm not thinking about, am I going to put my signature on it? Like, this is by Michael. I'm like, does this reflect, you know, my aesthetic vision, my values, my sense of, you know, cultural history? Am I balancing these elements right? Should I add the word chiaroscuro into my prompt to get a nicer lighting? Like, so I'm, you know, to me, it's like it's a way to express your education in art history and art theory. And that's all there. Like that's to me, that doesn't go away. And the only thing different is that maybe I can't stamp my name on it as much.
How do you sort of introduce that into the classroom with your students' works, for example? I know you that's really interesting that you talk to them about copyright. I think that's really an important perspective that in our programs generally they don't get a lot of talk about policy. But yeah, when you give them assignments, you know, how do you scaffold that? How do you talk to them about?
The other thing too is I've redesigned my photography course. Now it's called digital photography. Now it's called digital, virtual, and AI photography. And the AI there is really to get the students to, it's a way of integrating the ideas from the lectures and readings into the AI. So it's a pedagogical tool mainly. So if I talk about exposure or lens types or deadpan photography, take those ideas from the lecture and then do it in your prompt writing. So the prompt writing becomes a way of revisiting the course concept. So I use the AI strictly pedagogically, but the point is for them to actually do the prompts. Okay, in this image, I have a Leica lens, it's 50 millimeters, fast exposure, fast fall off, whatever. I use AI a lot personally, but then I share how I use AI with students just to present, not, you know, the model, a model, of this, or yeah, some model. So like, these are some ways you can use it. For my game design course, I say, look, most of you don't have an art and design background, and if you want really great visuals, you know, it's fine to use AI, and that's one reason why you might want to use AI. And if you've got those design skills, then use them.
But once again, you know, where do we insert the ethics of environmental impact?
So it's almost a relief to me that the environmental impact of artificial intelligence is something that people are learning about. It's kind of harder to ignore. They draw, because they're both in their training and in their use, they draw on such massive amounts of calculation that, you know, it's been, you know, like training one large language model can uses as much energy as a human lifetime by one standard, or, you know, driving a car for a year by another standard. like all these numbers are kind of hard to compare, but they use a lot of electricity. And not only training, but also the iterations of use, or what they call inferences. So, you know, if you use ChatGPT or Google Translate, or you know, even the virtual backgrounds that we use, that some people use in video calls, you know, all of those are using AI to carry out calculations.
That's right. Yeah, background subtraction in real time, all of that stuff. Yeah, that's right.
So, and these have been just worked, you know, very, very quickly normalized in wealthy parts of the world, I have to say, in parts of the world where the infrastructure is robust and where people can expect to have kind of new devices. So again, it's a rich people's problem. It's kind of a white people's problem.
Well, yeah, we're creating the problem, but the whole world is experiencing the problem. So what can art do? What can all of us do, but what do you see as art's potential?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is something I'm actually kind of excited about because, image generation AI uses a humongous amount of electricity. Image generation uses 750 times as much electricity as a text classification AI for a single task. So it is a worry if lots of artists start just using AI to generate images. But there are, you know, for art and for other uses, really mostly for other uses, there are not only large language models, but there are small language models that don't have as many parameters, don't require as many passes to train the AI. So they use less energy. And something that my research group is planning to do in the next few months is create a tiny language model. So it's going to use very few parameters. It's going to be very efficient. And then we're hoping to incorporate it into the Small File Media Festival and invite artists to submit artworks made with a tiny language model. So they're probably going to be, you know, a little more abstract, a little more minimalist than things made with large language models. You know, they can be examples. So when we share our research, we'll say, hey, look at all the great ways to make art that includes a generative element, but can still be mindful about its environmental impact and be elegant and beautiful. So it's about awareness.
Yeah, and I really see this as the contribution from artists is kind of setting this example of an ethical, a fully ethical self-reflexivity about the work that you do and being very transparent about how it's using resources, what it's impacting. I think it's like setting an example and a model.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's ethical, and it weaves the ethics into the aesthetics. So we can say, oh, this is a really
Oh, I love that. Ethics.
We can enjoy that part of its beauty is that it has a light footprint.
you're not worried for your own creative work?
Well, I mean, if it becomes Terminator, John Connor will save us. No, I have crazy ideas. Like, I feel like all of our computer labs should have like those giant Frankenstein switches on the walls where we can just turn off the internet and just say like, and have little sparks flying off of it. And you just like, okay, haha, you all cannot use the internet now. Write with your fingers. Right. So, or we have the whole mountain here. We could do like boot camps in the woods where there's no cell signal and just make them write on paper. So I sometimes feel like we could probably use like internet free zones and actually make them do live writing, live thinking, live talking, where they're not going to be staring at their cell phone screen and like, looking, you know, so those, I don't know how practical that would be like across 30,000 students, but, you know, finding ways to get them to do some unenhanced writing and thinking for sure, like in your presence, is not going to hurt anything.
And it's about the variety, right? Like kind of alternating these modes, stimulating different parts of the brain, different skill sets, different activities.
And there we have it, two sides of the coin. Generative AI is standing on shoulders of giants. Prompt writing as art is itself an expression of creativity and knowledge. And on the other hand, the media geology of computing, the environmental cost to this mediation. Join us for more topics in AI in the future.
This has been an episode of Speakable. Speakable is also broadcast live on CJSF, SFU's campus radio at 90.1 FM. If you are a student interested in getting involved, drop us an email and stay updated on FCAT social media and at www.sfu.ca/FCAT/news/FCAT-podcasts/Speakable-podcast.
The SFU Disability and Neurodiversity Alliance, referred to as DNA, is a student-led network of community members who identify as disabled, autistic, neurodivergent, deaf, mad, and or as having a disability, a chronic illness, long-term condition, or a mental illness. At DNA, we work together to create campus change. We address ableism, and we promote disability justice while opposing oppression in all of its forms. We are the SFU Disability and Neurodiversity Alliance. We are DNA. We provide support for students who are having difficulty with their schooling or accessing the services they need. Email access@sfss.ca or drop by the DNA Resource Center, room 1300 in the sub-building. That was access@sfss.ca, room 1300 in the sub-building.
February 13th is World Radio Day, where millions around the globe celebrate the medium which touches so many lives. All across this country, Canadians are celebrating too, including Farm Radio International and the National Campus and Community Radio Association, with a live broadcast through CKCU-FM from Ottawa. Learn more and participate in World Radio Day at worldradioday.ncra.ca on February 13th and catch the live stream.
Renaissance Coffee is open at SFU. Parminder and his team have been serving the SFU community with great coffee for more than 20 years. If you're looking for a wholesome meal, delectable desserts, or something to warm yourself and lift your spirits, Renaissance Cafe is the place to be. Featuring fair trade espresso beverages and brewed coffee, Renaissance Coffee is open Monday to Friday from 7 a.m. to 3 p.m. Well, how do you get up and go?
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM in Burnaby, British Columbia.
Hello, this is Rabble Radio, recorded on Friday, January 31st, 2025. I'm your host, Brianne Doyle. Rabble.ca shares with you the news of the day through a progressive lens. If you're curious,